Good evening. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. I have no idea whether what he just told you was true or not. I do want to thank Arner for arranging to have me here. It's always an honor and a privilege to be anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I got to tell you, I love being in Iceland. I am of Icelandic descent, and I actually am absolutely very proud to be an Icelander. I want to thank Arner. He took me today to a genealogy society, and we tracked down some of my relatives. And I had known this for many, many years, that my great-grandfather, Bjarne Jonasson, he left Iceland. He left a wife and a daughter, Haldora Bjarnadóttir, here, and he married Thor and Elizabeth on the ship on the way to Canada. So he's also a documented alcoholic, so he's an alcoholic and a bigamist. So I come by my alcoholism from you. That is. And Arner and I found out that we are actually related. We had them track it, and we found the culprit that we're related to. It's 1656. We have a common ancestor. And I really enjoyed the first speaker. I can't pronounce your name. Katya? Something. Didn't understand a word you said, but I could tell you love Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to tell another story that made me so proud to be an Icelander. This is my fourth time in Iceland. And on my third time in 2003, I was staying at a bed and breakfast downtown, and I woke up very early on a Sunday morning. And maybe 5:30, 6 a.m., and I decided to take a walk into downtown Reykjavik. And there were hundreds of you on the street. Men were previously sharply dressed, but they were passed out in doorways. There were women who were nicely dressed, but they had blood on the side of their face, and they were helping each other up the street. And in the United States, when you're at a sporting event, They play the national anthem, and you stand there, and you are to be proud to be an American, or at least act like you're proud to be an American. And that morning, as I stood there and watched you behave, I was just so proud to be an Icelander. I just... Oh. Oh. And then I saw the street cleaners sweeping everybody up and rounding you up. Anyway, I'm an alcoholic. It's the most important thing I can tell you about myself is that I'm an alcoholic. And the reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is really very simple. I've got a very bizarre and strange relationship with alcohol. That's why I'm alcoholic. No other reason. I will tell you a bunch of stories. However, the reason I'm an alcoholic is because I've got a very strange relationship with alcohol. And this first part of this strange relationship that I have with alcohol happens when I drink it. A very strange thing happens when I drink alcohol. The book calls it an allergic reaction, and the book says the symptom of this allergic reaction that I get when I drink alcohol is what they call the phenomena of craving. And the best way that I can describe this thing that the book calls the phenomena of craving is that whenever I drink booze, the more I drink, the thirstier I get. It happens with nothing else, just booze. An example of that is I've got this glass of water up here, and over the next hour or so that I'm talking with you, I will probably drink half, I don't know. If my mouth gets dry, I might finish this whole glass of water. But I can absolutely guarantee you that once I finish this glass of water, I am not going to go get a case of water and lock myself in my hotel room. I'm not. But if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, this strange physical reaction, this craving that I get, if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, well then, just say no would solve alcoholism. In the early 80s, our president's wife, Nancy Reagan, came out and had a national campaign saying, just say no. Right? If that were true, I would, and I imagine you would, just go, ha, 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 no. And just go on and live a happy, successful life and just saying no. But I have this other part of my strange relationship with alcohol, and that happens when I'm not drinking it. Of and by myself, if I don't drink for a day, a week, or a month, I seem to have this mind that is able to paint a picture that makes it okay to take another drink. No matter what the pain, humiliation, and suffering of a day, a week, or a month ago was, and it does not matter whether it was my pain and humiliation or your pain and humiliation. It does not matter. But sooner or later, my mind is able to rationalize and justify my walk back to the next drink at all costs. So I can't drink successfully because of this physical craving that happens when I drink. But I cannot, on my own, not drink successfully. I'm damned if I do. I'm damned if I don't. It's the ultimate catch-22 we call alcoholism. Because if I could do either one of those two things, if I could drink successfully, that's what I would be doing tonight. I would be drinking successfully. Or if on my own, I could not drink successfully, that's what I would be doing tonight. I would just be at home not drinking. But I can't do either one of those. So this is why I'm alcoholic. And I set this relationship up with alcohol that I just described to you right from the get-go when I first started drinking. And I started drinking a lot later than a lot of people in AA. I was 11. Well, I feel that's kind of late. I mean, I was feeling very old as I was listening to our first speaker because I did the math. And I got sober when he was 3 years old. Our family lived in Seattle at that time. A typical morning for me in seventh grade would be I'd show up early for school, not for study hall or anything, but to meet my new friends at the very edge of the school property, Loser's Corner. Right? It's where kids would hang out in the early morning, smoke cigarettes, and try to look cool. And we would also have what I like to call the playground cocktail. That is a jar full of whatever we could rip off out of the parents' liquor cabinet the night before. And that jar is very scary because none of us have been to bartending school yet. So there are equal amounts of whiskey, vodka, cream de menthe, vermouth in that jar. I mean, there's green things floating around in that jar. And you can imagine five or six of us, 11, 12-year-olds, trying to choke that down. And of course, it was the early 1970s, so we were smoking what we call commercial pot. Anybody remember that stuff? Four-finger lids, $10 a bag, seeds and stems and the whole bit. And it was even before Ziploc bags were invented, when it would just be a regular Glad sandwich bag, and as you'd roll it up, there'd be like nine people spit on it. Right? And we'd pack all those seeds and stems and leaves into a homemade pipe, maybe made out of plumbing fittings and a screen. Or if you're really desperate that morning, it would be a toilet paper roll with aluminum foil and pinholes in it. Were you guys there too? Yeah, it's at this point that many people that speak in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, they often interrupt themselves, and they say something like this: I don't mean to offend anybody, but drugs are a part of my story. I know and understand and have respect for what they're attempting to do when they apologize for that. They're attempting to protect singleness of purpose, or show respect for it. Vitally important aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous. But that idea aside, I still think it's a very bizarre practice for alcoholics to apologize to other alcoholics for doing drugs while drinking or in between drunks. I understand apologizing to police officers and judges and people that may still love us, but I don't know why we apologize to each other. In fact, the most bizarre example of that I've ever seen, I was in a big meeting in West Los Angeles a number of years ago. And that night, the speaker was up there giving one of the most ugly, heinous, blow-by-blow drunkologues I've ever heard. And I got to tell you, when I'm out there listening to a speaker, and when his story gets ugly, the uglier it gets, the more excited I get. That night, I was on the edge of my chair, drooling, looking up at this guy, going, yeah, buddy, go, 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 go. And at one point in this really ugly story, this speaker said, you know, I had four DUIs, that's driving under the influence. I had four of them. I was in front of the judge, and the judge said, if I get one more DUI, I'm going to prison for sure. He says, 2 weeks later, I'm on the freeway, and I hit a family of four, and I'm in a blackout, and I wound up in prison. And in prison, I sodomized men. I was sodomized, and I don't mean to offend anybody, but I did some drugs too. I was the only one that thought that was strange that night. Everybody else was, oh, okay. So by the time I'm 14 there in Seattle, I'm the neighborhood drunk. I'm the neighborhood pot dealer. I forgot to mention, but my father was a neighborhood Lutheran minister. No, he was not laughing. And my parents, really good people. Really, really good people. And they tried to help. They saw what was happening to me, but they didn't understand it. See, they blamed my problems. You couldn't miss it. You couldn't miss what was happening. Because by the time I'm 14, I'm growing my hair down in front of my very bloodshot eyes, and my vocabulary at 14 was, whoa. Whoa. That's my vocabulary. I'm regularly locked in my bedroom listening to Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, Deep Purple, getting all the necessary tools for living from those lyrics, you know. And my parents tried to help. They tried to help, but they didn't understand that their son was alcoholic. They blamed my problems on people, places, and things. They thought, if we can get him away from that damn group of kids he's hanging out with, things will get better. If we can get him out of that damn public school system, things will get better. They tried all of the above. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. My problems are not based upon people, places, and things. My problems are based upon my physical and mental relationship to alcohol. You see, if you change the people, places, and things in somebody's life like mine, all that happens is that I'm loaded with different people. In different places, ruining different things. That's all that happens. So by the time I was maybe close to 18, I barely scraped out of the public school system after being kicked out of the private school system. I barely scraped out of the public school system there in Seattle. And my parents decided that Seattle is the problem. If we can get them out of Seattle, things will get better. So they sent me 300 miles away to Washington State University. And I spent 3 years at that university on my parents' money. And in that 3 years, I got almost 10 credits. At any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content, about a 0.25. I did nothing at that school, just... By the time I was 22, this little story I'm about to tell you will let you know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, my father was Swedish, my mother is Icelandic, therefore, I look like a polar bear. And I... But at Christmas time, my parents wouldn't just send up, and I don't know whether this is a Scandinavian thing or whether it's a Lutheran thing, I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents wouldn't just send out Christmas cards to their friends and relatives. My parents would send out this big, long Christmas letter that said everything the family had been doing that year. When I was about 22 years old, I got a hold of one of these letters that had been sent out the previous Christmas, and as I read it, it let me know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, the first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year, another impressive year, I'm sure. The next paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year, and that paragraph went something like this. Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with a master's degree in human resources. She's now working for a large pharmaceutical company in the Midwest. She traveled to Europe this summer. She saw this, she saw that. Her hobbies are this, this, and this. She's a very happy young woman. We are very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in marketing. He's now working for a large advertising firm here in downtown Seattle. He loves to golf. He loves to travel. He's engaged to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou, who works for a very small company here in Seattle named Microsoft. It was small at one time. And they love to golf together. They love to travel together. He's a very happy young man. We are very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. It's about this same time that a really bad night happened. It would take me till breakfast to describe everything that happened, so I'm going to just say it in one sentence. A really bad night happened, so I joined the Navy. It was a bad night. And what I'm about to tell you should scare you if you fear the United States security. But on my way into the Navy, I passed a potential test. They call it the ASVAP test. And this test that I took qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should concern you. That the United States Navy would even think maybe, possibly, or even remotely about putting somebody like me near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at boot camp, and I could not pass that test. That test they call a urinalysis test is what they call that. And I still remember, I had been in boot camp for about a week, and a master at arms, that's like the military police, came into the barracks, and he had a clipboard, and there was about five or six names on that clipboard, and I knew my name would be on that clipboard. We were taken out of the boot camp barracks, and we were taken over to the other side of the Great Lakes Naval Base, to the administrative side. And the other men were taken into one office, and I was taken into another office. I was marched right into the commanding officer's office, the man who ran the whole Great Lakes Naval Base. I mean, it was a big oak desk in his office and pictures of naval vessels on the wall. And the man behind this desk had so much gold on that would blind you on a bad morning. And he asked me my name, and I gave him my name. And this would have been the early 80s. And so he had this telephone on this big desk. And attached to the telephone was a speakerphone attachment. And he pushed the button on the speakerphone attachment, and into this speakerphone he said, "Walter," that's my father's name. My father had been a reservist chaplain in the United States Navy at that time for over 40 years. This was an old World War II buddy of my father's. And so into this phone, this man said, "Walt, out of consideration for our long-term friendship, I thought I would call you first before I took any action. But your son has gone positive on his first year analysis test, and I should be kicking him out right now. But out of consideration for our long-term friendship, I wanted to ask you, what do you feel we should do with your son?" Now, normally, if you met my father, just in his body language and in his voice, you could tell that this man was very passionate about life, that he was very grateful for what many of the experiences that he'd had the privilege of having in his life. You could tell that when you would meet him. You would feel it in his voice and in his body language. But there was another voice that would come out, and it was a voice like somebody had just kicked him below the belt. And I had heard that voice many times, and it was always when he was dealing with me. And that was the voice that I heard come through that telephone that day as I stood there. And I heard my father's very weak and destroyed voice say, "It's just none of my concern anymore." Click, dial tone. Even as I stand here today, I can still hear that of the dial tone as the man looked up at me. That man decided to keep me in the Navy anyway, but they took away that nuclear status thing. Thank God for you guys. And a year and a half later, I'm a lower rank than when I first came in. that can really happen to anybody. I don't know if you know this, but in order to survive as a low-ranking enlisted man in the United States Navy, all you have to do is show up in the same place each day in a uniform. You just have to show up where you left the day before in a uniform, and you can get by. I cannot accomplish that. This is apparently was my problem. I would be out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and I would look at my surroundings. I would look, and I go, "By God, I'm in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. I'm on a big gray ship. I'm in a uniform. No doubt about it, I am in the United States Navy." However, that ship would pull into a port, and I would leave that ship, and I would take a drink. And I would totally forget that I'm in the United States Navy. And at this point in my life, whenever I took a drink, I have no idea, once I take a drink, whether the drunk is going to be 3 hours or 3 days. I have no idea. And it's a very strange feeling at 6 a.m. in a foreign country on a very large pier, and I would be standing there going, there was a destroyer here the other day. This one morning, I was driving my car back into the base. I was late to get back to the ship. I'd been drinking all weekend. And what I would be doing, a typical Monday morning, if I had been drinking all weekend, this is Carl's detox plan, his way of sliding into Tuesday, is that I would save one pint, and I would drink half that pint on my way into the Navy base. I would keep the other half a pint underneath the seat so at noontime I could run back out to the car and I'd drink the other half a pint, and that would be my way of coming off of a drunk and sliding into Tuesday. This particular morning, at the front of every American Navy base, there is a guard shack where a Marine stands guard. And if you're going to bring your car onto the base, you need to pull up at this guard shack. You need to show him your military ID. He needs to check the sticker that is on your car. And if everything matches up, he allows you to proceed forward onto the base. This particular morning, I guess I was concentrating more on getting that half a pint in me than watching where I was going. And all of a sudden, I looked up and I saw the Marine had his head out of the guard shack. And I was wondering what he was so excited about until I looked down and I was still going 40 miles an hour. And I tried to swerve at the last minute, and the car hit this median that was on the right-hand side. The car flipped over and bam, right through the guard shack. I can still see that Marine doing this big dive out of there. I remember in all of the twisted metal and broken glass, as I was laying in the back of the car upside down, and it was just destruction all around, the only thing I thought about, I wasn't thinking, oh my God, have I hurt this Marine? Am I all right? It's not what I was thinking. My only thought process was, where's that bottle? And I started to scramble around looking for that bottle. Now, I'm not looking for that bottle because I need to hide it because that would be evidence to incriminate me. I mean, it's just, you know, I'm looking for that bottle because, based upon my experience in situations like this, once the authorities arrive and they see what's going on, it's going to be a while till I get a drink. So I want to get the last little bit in because I know it's going to be one of these times where powers that be take alcohol away from me. That morning, the Marine was all right. They were patching me up at the hospital for minor injuries, and they were reading new charges on me. And new charges is nothing new in my life. That's just what happens in a guy's life like mine about every 90 days if you're living the way I'm living, right? The alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. So new charges, this is nothing new. But the most significant thing that happened that morning while I was at the hospital is the Navy doctors prescribed this thing called antabuse for me. And they sent this prescription back to the ship's doctor, and I was now under orders to show up at sick bay every morning before work, before quarters, and the corpsman there would put this little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for a half an hour to make sure it actually ingested in my system. Over the next 7 to 10 days, I started to experience the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of this disease we call alcoholism, and that is I had no alcohol in my system. And I was slowly going insane. You see, you take alcohol away from an alcoholic of my type, and I assume your type. And I literally become, I start to implode in on myself. The best way that I can describe the way I feel when you take alcohol away from me and you do not give me Alcoholics Anonymous is that I feel like a scream looking for a mouth. And I remember counting those days on that antabuse just... It's been 4 days, and I'm on antabuse. Now it's been 6 days, and I'm on antabuse. Now it's been 8 days, 6 hours, and 15 minutes, and I'm on antabuse. And I started to look around that ship. The other men, they're talking behind my back. All 300 of them. Have you ever felt that way in AA? The only difference is that in AA, we are talking behind your back. It's not an illusion, it's actually happening. Only with love and tolerance in Iceland, I'm sure. On the 10th day, I just snapped, and I went AWOL from my ship. That's absent without leave. I went AWOL from my ship, and I locked myself in a little hotel room in downtown San Diego. It's called the Plaza Hotel. This would have been 1986. It was $13 a night. They have rehabbed the downtown San Diego along with the Plaza Hotel. I checked a couple of years ago. It's now $13.95 a night. And I remember I locked myself in this little hotel room and I had a bottle of vodka and a shot glass. And as I sat on the edge of the bed looking at this bottle of vodka that was on this rickety little end table, I remembered that the Navy doctors had given me a very stern warning about drinking on top of Anabuse when they had prescribed it for me. They had told me, son, you need to understand that if you drink on top of this Anabuse, you will get one of two reactions. One reaction is you will get violently ill. The other reaction is you might die. I remember looking at the bottle and I thought, well, I wonder which reaction I'm going to get. And I took one shot and nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes just to make sure. And I took another shot. All of a sudden I felt tingly in the face. So I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room and I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden I could feel my heart going, boom, boom, boom. Looked at my shirt. I was drenched in sweat. And then all of a sudden I was like, hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. You guys are very sick if you think this is funny. In fact, I have proof, although you all look very, very nice, I have proof of how sick you are. I'm going to skip ahead a couple of years, 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got an honorable discharge out of the Navy, and one of the amends that my first sponsor and his sponsor, real sticklers about that ninth step, and one of the amends that I was not able to accomplish while I was still in the Navy was that my parents had paid for a bachelor's degree in college. I did not have one. I had two choices. I either had to pay them back, or I had to go get what they had paid for. Those were my choices. I know that's bad news for some of you young people. But after I got out of the Navy, that's how I wound up living in the Los Angeles area where I live now. And I signed up to take this business telecommunications bachelor's program. And in the first couple of semesters of this bachelor's program in telecommunications and business that I took, I had to take a business presentation course. It's like a speech class, I guess. And in the first couple of days of this speech class, the instructor was randomly pointing at the students, having them come up front one at a time. The instructor would throw out a topic, and each student was supposed to talk for 2 to 3 minutes on whatever the topic was. And the instructor was just doing this to see what he had to work with for the semester. And after about 7 or 8 students were called on, he called on me. And I walk up to the front of the room, and from the back of the room, the instructor shouted out, "Talk about a bizarre situation in your life." So I told them about drinking on top of Anabuse. They did not respond the way you guys responded. They were like, there were, though, a couple of guys in the back going, "Hey, right on, dude, all right." So anyway, I'm back in the hotel room. I'm red-faced. I'm hyperventilating. I'm sweating. And I took another shot. And up it came. My second sponsor, the late Eddie Cochran, one of the pioneers of Southern California Alcoholics Anonymous. He used to call this, the next thing that happened to me, projectile regurgitation. This is a different type of puking. We all know our normal puking. It's like you're out there in the middle of a drunk, right? And you get a little warning, a little sour taste in the back of your throat. Maybe a little bit comes up into your mouth and you go, And you know, based upon experience, you have between 30 seconds and about 1 minute to find a bathroom if there happens to be one. If you're driving, you just got to get the window down, right? If it's your friend's shoe tonight, oh well, that's the way it goes. But you get the warning. Here on this Anabuse, no warning, just boom. Kind of a spray across the room. And thank God, the Plaza Hotel is the type of hotel room where the toilet is in the same room as the bed. It's a design feature, I believe. Maybe to make convicts feel more at home upon release. I'm not really sure. But it came in handy. But I found the magic of drinking on top of Anabuse, that if I would hang in there and not die. And those are the two things that you need to get going on at the very same time if you are going to drink on top of Anabuse. You got to hang in there. There's no half measuring this. You got to be committed. Right? And at the very same time after this commitment, don't die. If you can piece those two things together, I encourage you, have at it. But I found that if I kept drinking and I kept puking and I kept drinking and I kept puking for approximately 1 hour, some nights it was an hour and a half, but enough of the Anabuse would kick out of my system and I would quit throwing up and I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating and sweating, and I'm all right with that. So I drank on top of Anabuse the last 7 months of my drinking. The only words to describe this are desperation drinking. My second to my last drunk, I was left for dead in a motel parking lot in an area of San Diego called National City. You probably don't know what National City is like. National City, in relation to San Diego, is kind of like South Central Los Angeles is to Los Angeles. I was in the middle of a two-day drunk, and all of a sudden I thought, well, I'd like a little crack cocaine. So I started wandering around the streets of National City, going, anybody know where there's crack cocaine? Now, take a look at me. Does this seem like a good idea? I know right now, I can see it was a very bad idea. But at the time, I thought it was brilliant. The next thing that I remember is that there were lots of fists flying. They were not mine. And then there was a lot of blood. And that's the that apparently was mine. And that's the last thing that I remember. And the next thing that I remember is I came to. And you know how when you come to out of a blackout, you start looking for evidence as to, am I in my own bedroom? Am I in jail? Where am I? You start looking around to see where you are. You've heard many times in AA people trying to describe pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization and their gratitude for sobriety, where they say, I'm just so grateful to be sober. When I wake up, I know who's next to me. I just can't believe it. When I'd be drinking, I'd come out of a blackout and look next to me and, And they're trying to describe some sort of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization here. But that's not really pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Real demoralization is when you come out of a blackout, you look next to you and you go, wow, not bad. And they wake up and look at you and they go, And now they're out. You see, there's always two sides to every story, you know. Anyway, this particular morning, when I came to, I saw men and women with surgical masks on and tools in their hands and bright lights. And I was on an operating table. Now, anybody in the medical profession, I don't know if it's true here in Iceland, but in the United States, if someone shows up and they're obviously under the influence of alcohol and drugs and they don't know and I can't talk, my jaw was broken in three places. They are doing surgery on my jaw. But it's against the law to give them anesthesia when they don't know what combination of alcohol or drugs is in your system, because the anesthesia might kill you if you have the wrong combination of alcohol or drugs in it. So there I was being operated on that morning with no anesthesia. That was a fun morning. My last night of drinking, I'm being led out of the San Diego jail, being transferred from military authorities over to military authorities. I'm in handcuffs. And it's one of those mornings where neck muscles aren't working too well. And there was lots of angry people around, and I'm in handcuffs. And that morning, as I was coming up with the military police up to the quarter deck of our ship, the officer of the deck that morning put his arm up and said, wrong answer. Orders have already been processed on this loser last night. The orders are 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or treatment. Now, as I stood there in handcuffs that morning, apparently some sort of option was thrown out on the table. 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or treatment. Now, as I stood there in the handcuffs, I do not remember thinking, oh, God, you are so good to a bum like me. I just can't go on living this way. And look at this. You've offered me treatment. Oh, I am so great. I don't remember thinking or feeling that. Nor do I remember, and this would have been more likely, nor do I remember thinking, hey, if I just act like I want that treatment thing, maybe I can beat this charge too. That would have been more likely, but I don't remember that either. I now know that it would not have mattered what I was thinking or feeling that morning because I was in handcuffs. And I don't know about your experience in handcuffs, but my experience in handcuffs throughout my life, whoever had me in handcuffs, never once did they ever turn to me and say, "So what's your opinion on this matter?" When you're in handcuffs, you go where they say. And they took me up to this treatment center, a military treatment center up at the north end of San Diego at the Miramar base. That's where they filmed Top Gun. Our section was called Top Drunk. And when the doors were locked behind me, that is when they were willing to take the handcuffs off me. And that is what society feels about how Carl Morris acts out there in the world without Alcoholics Anonymous. They're willing to take the handcuffs off me when the doors are locked behind me, and rightfully so. When I drink, I have no consideration for you or your children. I don't think of anything about the penalty of the way I can drastically harm your life in any way, shape, or form. So I'm in this military treatment center, and over the next couple of days, 35 men and women show up from various ships, bases, and commands, and we're all going to do this 45-day thing together. And in the first couple of days, they are doing medical checkups on us. They are doing administrative paperwork to find out who we are and where we're from. And they also were putting us into these large group therapy sessions. And in the first couple of days, when we're in this big group therapy session, the facilitator or the instructor for the group therapy was trying to get us to talk to each other. And nobody's talking. We're all just arms folded, looking down at the ground. Nobody's saying anything. And this facilitator, I believe he was new at his job, was getting more frustrated by the minute because he was running out of things to say. And none of us would talk. And on about the third day, we were in one of these group therapy sessions, and this fellow named Paco, he was from some other base or ship somewhere, he raises his hand in the group therapy session. And the instructor goes, "Yes, yes, yes, what would you like to say, Paco?" And Paco said, "I hear that I'm supposed to be rigorously honest with you guys if I'm going to do this staying sober thing. And I want you guys to know that Paco is not my real name. Paco is just a name I've used my whole life whenever things look like trouble. And the other day when I got here, this looked like trouble. But I want to be honest and upfront with you guys. My real name is Randy. Will you guys call me Randy from now on?" And the rest of us kind of go, "Okay, great to meet you, Randy, whatever." And we look back down to the ground. But this facilitator got really excited and said, "Oh my God, this is the first breakthrough of any honesty of any of you SOBs." Later that afternoon, Randy was paraded in front of the rest of us. They put a gold name tag on him that said Randy. And then we were all informed that whenever staff was not around, Randy's in charge. And Randy loved his new job. And we hated Randy. On the seventh day in this place, they took us all to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. At least it was my first meeting. All I remember is that we were in the barracks, and over the 1MC, it's like an intercom system, announcement system through the barracks. They said, "Civilian close, parking lot, 6 p.m. And so we're all out there standing in our civilian clothes. And five white vans pull up, and we were told which van to get into, and five or six of us were put into each van, and each van took off out into San Diego to a different meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the van I was in showed up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we were sitting in the back, and you people started your meeting. And as I sat there in the back, now in San Diego, if you've ever been there, most of their participation meetings are what they call podium participation. You do not share from your seat. You share from up front. And all I remember is a long string of people, 10, 12, maybe 15 people, coming up to this podium, and the first few read something, and then the rest of them just sort of seemed to talk off the cuff for a few minutes each. And as I sat there and listened to what was being said up here, I got this overwhelming feeling of, oh my God, they know. They know. Now, if one of you would have seen me back there thinking, and you would have walked up to me and nudged me and said, "So what is it that they know that you think you know?" I would have said, "I don't know." But they know. And what it was, in looking back, is that I believe those people were sharing responsibly in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I believe I was hearing what Alcoholics Anonymous wants any new person to hear in their very first meeting or two. What was happening was that I was identifying. And I was identifying with two things. I was identifying with the way that you described your drinking, and even more importantly, I was identifying with the way you described the way you felt when you were not drinking. The other thing that I remember from my very first meeting is this one fellow got called on, and he walked all the way to the front. He said one sentence, and he sat down. And in the 24 years that I've been with you in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have never heard the alcoholic mind described better than by this gentleman. He walked all the way to the front. He introduced himself. He said, "My name's Jack. I'm an alcoholic. My mind would have killed my body a long time ago, except it needed it for transportation." And he sat down and he knows. He knows. The next night we went to another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know where that meeting was, but as much as I identified on the first night, I got just as confused the next night. Because everybody at this meeting was talking about something called a drug of choice. They were, "Well, my drug of choice is." And somebody else, "Well, my drug of choice is." And I'm sitting in the back going, "Oh, for God's sake, was I supposed to be choosing out there? Do they want me to choose now? What are they talking about?" So the next morning, I'm back at the treatment center, and I asked the counselor who'd been assigned to us. Her name was Mary, a wonderful woman. And I said, "Mary, I'd like to ask you a question." She goes, "Yes, what would you like to ask, Carl?" And I go, "Last night in the meeting, they were talking about something called a drug of choice. What do they mean by that?" And she said, "Carl, let's play a game." Now, that kind of worried me, because she was insinuating that I was supposed to concentrate on what she was about to say. And that concerned me, because I hadn't told anybody this, because I didn't know what was going on. I now know what was happening in my first week or so inside the treatment center. When I had shown up and they did a medical checkup on me, they had found that my liver was extended, my pancreas was shutting down, I had extreme alcoholic edema, apparently drinking on top of Anabuse for 7 months does a little number on your inside. So they had put me on to these detox medication, anti-seizure medication, apparently to stop me from throwing the floppy fish during a therapy session and scaring all the other residents, right? Right? It can get them worried, right? If somebody's always, right? So they had salted my tail with these things so I wouldn't throw the seizure. But if you've ever been on these things, you know what I'm talking about. Your field of vision about like this is just fine. But there's dancing squiggly things over here. And when I would turn to see what it is, now it's over here. And so I was doing a lot of this. So if you're ever at an AA meeting, and they bring the hospital people in, and they still got their hospital bracelets on, and they're doing a bunch of this, now you know what's probably going on. But anyway, so she goes, "Carl, we'll figure out what your drug of choice is. Let's play a game." I'm like, "Okay." She says, "Imagine this, Carl. Imagine I walked into this room and I had a tray. And on that tray, I had a bottle of Jack Daniels, an ounce of cocaine, and an ounce of Thai sticks. Which one would you take?" I started to drool immediately. "Oh, oh, 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 oh. I take them all." And she started to snap her fingers. "Settle down, Carl. Play the game. You can't have them all. You can only have one. Which one would you take?" And I thought for a second. I said, "Well, I guess if I can only have one, Mary, I guess I'd take the ounce of cocaine." She said, "Ah, maybe cocaine is your drug of choice. Do you understand now?" And I said, "No, no." And she said, "What's the problem?" Well, I said, "Mary, the only reason I would take the ounce of cocaine over the other two is, well, I'd take that ounce of cocaine, I'd get the hell out of this place, and I'd sell 2 8-balls. Now I'd have enough money for a quarter pound of Thai sticks and a case of Jack Daniels." Now, there's two reasons I bring this up. First reason is, I was 25 years old. I'm dying of a disease I know nothing about, and I'm still a smartass. That's what's first thing. Second thing, the reason I bring this up is to bring up a very important aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're new or fairly new, and that's sobriety dates. No, if you're new or fairly new and you're going through, am I mostly alcoholic and a little bit addict? Am I mostly addict, maybe just a little bit alcoholic? First thing I want to encourage you to do is go to lots of open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Find somebody who understands the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, who can take you through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, so that you can find out what alcoholism really is before you make the potentially fatal decision you are not. That's the first thing I want to encourage you to do. The second thing is, there's only one sobriety date. Right? I know there's lots of you that work with new people, and maybe you run across this scenario like I do every once in a while. Not very often, but every once in my once in a while in my home group, I run across this situation. See some guy around that I'd seen for a little while, and I go up to him and say, "Hey, good to see you. How long do you have?" And every once in a while, again, not often, but every once in a while, I get this kind of response. "Well, my drinking sobriety date is January 4th. My pot clean date is May 3rd. Oh, I blew my methamphetamine date last night. I was in Walmart all night long." No, one sobriety date. Funniest thing I ever heard about sobriety date, same scenario. I saw this guy around my home group for a while, and I went up to him and said, "Hey, good to see you. How long do you got?" And he said, "Well, I had 90 days, but I drank last night, so now I have 89 days. I had to call my sponsor. I think that kind of falls into the same category as being down in Mexico, looking at the tequila going, "Would that affect my U.S. sobriety date?" Yes. Yes. Sobriety dates are international. Just a little information for the new guy. So anyway, after 45 days, they're going to let us all out of this place, and they're going to let us out on a Friday afternoon. And on the Wednesday before that Friday, they gathered all 35 of us that were going to get out on that Friday, and they put us into this room. And from a side door, the door opened up, and the biggest, meanest counselor in the place walked in, and he's a Marine. And that day, he's in his full dress uniform. And I got to tell you, a United States Marine in his full dress uniform is a very impressive and very intimidating sight. I mean, he had all his medals on, and he marched up to this podium that was in front of us, and he stared at us. And as he stared at us, we all just went, and it just went dead quiet in that room. And he just stared at us. He didn't say a word. He just panned the room and stared at us. And after what seemed like forever, he finally spoke. He said, "You 35 have been through one of the finest treatment centers in the world for alcoholism and drug addiction, and over the years, this treatment center has done statistics. And our statistics show us that out of you 35, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Many of you will die, go insane, wind up in prison." Nice little exit pep talk, don't you think? God. Then he said, "Many of you will relapse once, twice, maybe 20 times, then make it back into long-term sobriety. But according to our statistics for this treatment center, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. If you thought it was quiet before that, you could have heard a pin drop in the room now. The only thing you could hear was me going, shit. Because I knew if only one of us was going to make it, it was not going to be me. We all knew who it was going to be. It's going to be Randy over here, guaranteed. He's like the poster boy of the treatment center by now." So on this Friday afternoon when they're letting us all out and people are taken back to their ship's base and commands in various different ways, but there was about four or five of us that had been arrested in vehicles the night before we were thrown into this place. So we were informed that we were supposed to stand on the front doorstep of the treatment center and our cars would be brought out of the impound lot where they'd been sitting for the last 45 days. So I'm standing there with a few guys and we're looking at each other and we're kind of just chatting, and all of a sudden one of the guys that I'm standing with points at this car that's coming across the parking lot. And he goes, "Is that Randy in that car?" And we look, yeah, sure enough. As he got a little closer, one of the other guys goes, "He's drinking already." Sure enough, Randy's got himself a bottle. He's polishing it off. He rolls right in front of us. He rolls down the window. He throws the bottle right at our feet. Crash! We look up. He gives us all the finger, and he drives right off. I guess his name was Paco again. I don't know. Next thing that I remember of that day is I showed up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, a 6 o'clock gong show meeting in Pacific Beach, north end of San Diego. Big meeting, and I'm sitting in the back. And the truth about my life at that time, I had 45 days without a drink. I had a lot of information, and I was physically feeling better than I had felt since I was a young teenager. But there had been no spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, or even a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. I had information, 45 days, feeling physically better. If there was ever a turning point in my life, it was right there at that meeting, that night. Which way is my life going to go? And that night, one guy operating on his primary purpose that night. I'm sure there was many, many other men that were operating on their primary purpose that night, but this fellow was the one that found me in the back. And he came up to me and goes, "I've never seen you here before. What are you doing?" I didn't think quick enough to lie to him, because I would have thought, if I would have thought for one more second, I would have made up a lie. But I accidentally told him the truth. And I said, "I don't know. I just got out of a Navy treatment center this afternoon. I don't know what I'm doing." This guy's eyes went, bing, big smile went across. He looked like he had just hit the jackpot in Las Vegas. He was like, "Ah!" At the break of the meeting, he's fighting his friends off. "No, no, no, he's mine. I got him. I got him. You stay away. I got him." I didn't know there's guys in AA that lurk around meetings looking for the new guy who accidentally will admit he doesn't know what he was doing. But there was something else going on in this guy's life that particular Friday night that made him especially glad to meet me. This guy's girlfriend had left him the night before for one of his friends in his home group. So he was wondering what he was going to do with his weekend: homicide, suicide, get loaded, or grab this newcomer. He was like all over me all weekend. We went to like 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this guy was insane over this woman. In between the meeting, in between each meeting, he'd throw me into the passenger side of his car, and he'd start driving, and he'd start yelling. He wouldn't even look at the road. He had like one of those AA radar cars that just made it to the next meeting, I guess. And he'd be yelling at me, "You got to go to meetings, you got to read the book, you got to get a sponsor. Damn her! Got to go to meetings, got to read the book, damn her!" And I'm like... Now, I didn't know it, but I was getting a very early introduction to your typical AA relationship breakup is what I was getting. But I'm so glad that this man, that night, in his pain, was a man in Alcoholics Anonymous who had taken the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, had done the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, and understood that the solution to his pain was out of self, out of self, out of self. I am so glad that that guy, that night, in his pain, was not a guy in AA who thought that his solution was, "I'll hide under my covers and I'll keep calling and keep calling until I can get my sponsor and he'll give me a magical answer." You know, I'm so glad that he was dragging my sorry butt around. And we, like I said, we went to like 18 meetings. Now, I'm sure that man found his sponsor during that barrage of meetings. I remember at most meetings, I'd see him off in a corner, and he'd be talking to the older fellows. And some of them looked like they were very concerned for him. They, Other ones would go, "Ha, ha, 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 ha." But invariably, they would turn him around, they'd point at me, he'd come barreling across, "We're going to another meeting." After that weekend, I got back to my ship. And the one other sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous on my ship was waiting for me. His name was Bob W. He became my first sponsor. I'm so grateful for this man for many, many reasons. But the main reason I am so grateful for this man is that the one other sober member of Alcoholics on my ship was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was living a very valuable way of life. He had a sponsor. He had commitments. He was trying to work with others. He was in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so glad that the one other guy on my ship that was sober was not a guy who hadn't been to a meeting in 9 months. who didn't know what to do with me, who didn't know how to really introduce me to Alcoholics Anonymous. The way of life that he was leading, and still did until last Tuesday, he passed away. And I missed being able to go see him. I had a flight to go on Friday, and he passed away on last Tuesday. So I tell the stories about my first sponsor, Bob W., with a very heavy heart tonight. And I'll try to get through. But the way of life he was living was such a valuable way of life, because all he had to do to effectively help save my life was stick his hand out and say, come do what I'm doing. Who else on the planet can effectively help save another life by saying, come do what I'm doing? Right? Nobody else on this planet. And it's very easy to forget how valuable it is to be an active, responsible member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because nobody can help us but us. As I said, he became my first sponsor for my first 2 years of sobriety that I was in the Navy. And he introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and we went to meeting. My first 6 months was meeting, coffee, 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 meeting, coffee, 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 meet a girl, meeting, coffee. And I would run around, I would go from meeting to meeting, desperately hoping that you would say something funny, clever, or insightful, because I knew that if you did, I would get this feeling of, I'm okay. No, I'm not. Meeting, coffee, 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 coffee. And I just, you know, I remember in this barrage of meetings, I'm confused about all sorts of things. I mean, I remember, I'm 4 months sober. I meet this girl at a meeting. Right? They call the break, and we look at each other. We say about two sentences to each other, and I run back out to my first sponsor, Bob, and he's standing outside the meeting with a bunch of his friends, and I go, Bob, you wouldn't believe this. I met this girl. God put her in my life. I know that she's an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. I mean, wow, we have so much in common. And one of his friends overheard this conversation and said, Carl, God's not a pimp. Like, oh. Meeting, coffee, meeting. And yet, as I ran from meeting to meeting in this sense of desperation, and I didn't understand that I was dying of untreated alcoholism as I was right in the midst of you, because late at night, I'd be holding my gut, whether I was on my ship in my rack, that's kind of a bunk on the ship, they'd stack you three high, whether I was there in the middle of the night or I'd gotten a hotel room and been to five meetings that day, I would still be holding my gut, and I would be saying the deadly statement of the new alcoholic. What's wrong with me? Why do I feel this way? What's wrong with me? And I would try to make it through the night. And I remember this one night. And again, this is an example of you people who know your responsibility at showing up at Alcoholics Anonymous no matter what. I decided, now, I'm really not a suicide kind of person. I'm like my late friend Scott Redmond used to say, I'm much more of a homicide type person. Much prefer your death to mine. But one night, that ugly, dark feeling was coming over me, and I go, if this is sobriety, I'm not going to be able to stay. And I started to think about suicide. Maybe not that seriously, I can't tell you. But the very next morning, I'm at a meeting, and I'm still thinking about it. And one of you beautiful members of Alcoholics Anonymous, this man didn't even know I was in the room. And he got up and he said, if anybody out there is thinking of committing suicide, I have it on good authority, which I knew by that time, if an old-timer is saying good authority, he means God. I have it on good authority that however you are feeling when you commit suicide is how you will feel for all eternity. Like, oh, that's bad news. Now, he's a responsible member, so he never states a problem without a solution. And he said, so the solution is, wait until you're having a very good day. Then do it. And I remember that man literally saved my life, because from the depths of my soul, I felt this laughter that came out. Oh! Right? And the release was amazing for about 15 minutes. And then I was back to... And some of the other things that just blew me away in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I remember this one time I'm sitting very, very new, and an old-timer said, if you don't take the first drink, you can't get drunk. And I was like, oh. And I wanted to say, did you hear that? I mean, it was major news. That was life-changing news for me. If I don't take the first drink, I can't get drunk. You know, and somebody else in the meeting said, when you're standing on the train tracks, it's not the caboose that gets you, it's the engine. And I thought this was brilliant. I mean, later that day, I'm outside the AA club going, if I don't take the first drink, I can't get drunk. If I don't... overwhelming, life-changing news. About a day later, now this is an example. Do not call or talk to and try to impress your loved ones that are not alcoholic with the deep spiritual sayings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I called my mother. Right? Now, my mother is very standoffish, rightfully so. They were in Seattle. I was in San Diego. They were most happy about the 1,000 miles between us. But she talked to me. She was hopeful. And I go, Mom, you wouldn't believe what I heard in the AA meeting tonight. They said, if I don't take the first drink, I can't get drunk. There was silence on the other end. After about 10 seconds, she said, a bunch of philosophers there in that AA program, huh? But it was life-changing news to me. Our ship had to go out to sea for 21 days straight when I was about between 6 and 7 months sober. My first sponsor, Bob W., told me, when our ship is out at sea, Carl, you are going to meet me in the engine room in this little battery shop every night at 6:30. And sure enough, the first night I met him there, he showed up and he had that blue book with him and he tossed it on the counter. He said, I've been hounding you about it for months. Have you read it? And I said something like, yeah, there's like how it works. We antagonists, some doctor with some opinion about something. What he proceeded to do with me over the next 21 days is I call it Alcoholics Anonymous in its purest form. Remember, he only had 14 more months than me. He was no expert at working with others. He was still just in the process of barely scratching the surface of getting his life going. But he opened up the book and he started to read from page one. And when he was tired, I would read. And what it was, and the reason I call it Alcoholics Anonymous in its purest form, is out there in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, in a little engine room, two men, the blind leading the blind, trying to have an experience with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? And what happened over that 21 days, when he and I did as best we could to do what that book was asking us to do, what I can best describe what happened to me was that I had was described in the back of the book under spiritual experience in the appendices as a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. It was a feeble attempt at the steps. I wrote it, you know, we went through 1, 2, and 3 as outlined in the book. I did enough of an inventory to maybe see a little bit of the truth of that I'm the master of my own destruction. Nobody had put me in this situation. I started to make an outline to make a few amends. And what happened to me is that I had a personality change. Enough of a, but that's not the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not where I was going to get long-term sobriety comfortably. That's not the real gift of Alcoholics Anonymous when I worked the steps. I was not to find the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, the real healing at the level of the soul that was going to be necessary for me to have long-term sobriety, until I did something else. Until I ever so feebly tried to do with someone else what he had done with me. In the 24 years that I've been with you, the deepest answers that I have found in my life as to who I am as a human being and what things mean and the deepest experiences that I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous have been when I've been trying to work with you. I have never had any of the deepest experiences when I'm working on myself. I truly believe that when I'm working on myself, I'm telling God, I'm fine, I got this. But when I am... Did I just flip that? Yeah. Didn't mean to do that. But when I am trying to help you is when God starts working in my life. I'm convinced that that is what has been the secret for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. The other thing that I learned during this period of time of my sobriety, I was probably about 8 months sober. And whenever, and this is what I learned. I learned that if I have found this solution and I am reasonably armed with facts about myself, I have a responsibility to take my seat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous because, as I said earlier, there's no one that can help us but us. So if I'm going to find this solution and then I disregard it, again, I'm being, at best, the lightest thing I can say is I'm being irresponsible. Because if nobody can help us but us, I have to take my seat. There's a magic that happens nowhere else, when one alcoholic tries to communicate with another alcoholic. There's a magic that happens nowhere else. And how I learned that, I will never forget. My first sponsor, Bob W., and I would often split hotel rooms when our ship would pull into a foreign port. We would split a hotel room just to get off the ship, and we would then go find the AA group. We were in Victoria, British Columbia this particular time, and we got a hotel room, and then we went out to the AA club, and we went to the meeting. After the meeting, Bob said, I'm really kind of tired. I don't know if I'm feeling that well. I'm going to head back and go to bed early back at the hotel. I said, okay. And I stayed out with the AAers and went to coffee, maybe another candlelight meeting. I don't know. A few hours later, I come back to the hotel room. And Bob has this man from our ship there in my bed. Blair, and he found Blair. His name is Blair. And Blair was wasted. Bob had found him in a gutter and had dragged him to my bed in our hotel room and had propped him up on the next to the headboard with an end table and a chair and a pillow. And Bob was reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to him. And I look at this scene, I go, this is ridiculous. Blair doesn't even know where he's at. I mean, Blair's like, right? And we're having to hold the chair and hold him up. And Bob's reading the big book. And I think, this is ridiculous. Blair didn't even know where he's at. But I threw my 2 cents in, and we got Blair back to the, we carried Blair back to the ship and put him in his rack. That's the last I heard of Blair for the next few weeks. A few weeks later, we're in San Diego. We're in port. And it's 3 a.m. in the morning. And I'm in my rack on the ship, and all of a sudden, Carl, wake up. And I go, what? And it's Bob. Bob says, Blair's on the Coronado Bridge. We're going to get him. Apparently, over the last few weeks, Blair has tried to drink. He's tried not to drink. Apparently, he's at the jumping off point. He's on the Coronado Bridge. And I don't know if you guys know about the Coronado Bridge down in San Diego. Big, big bridge. It's an extremely popular suicide spot. It's such a popular suicide spot that they actually have telephones up on the top directly connected to the suicide hotline just in case you have a little change of heart. They're hoping that you change your mind before you're in midair. And, you know, when we think, this might be a bad idea. And Blair had gotten onto this suicide hotline phone and was talking to a very well-meaning, highly educated suicide hotline counselor. And this is apparently what Blair was telling this counselor. I will only talk to Bob W. The counselor was saying, who's Bob W? Blair was saying, it's anonymous. So this counselor went and got her boss, another well-meaning, highly educated suicide hotline counselor, and they started doing the good cop, bad cop routine. And they started firing questions at him. And they found out that he's in the Navy and what ship he's from. So they decided to maybe take a shot in the dark, trying to find a needle in a haystack. They called down to the ship, my ship, to the quarterdeck at 3 a.m. And the suicide hotline people said, this is really a stab in the dark, but is there a Bob W. on that ship? Now, the man who answered the phone that morning out of the 300 men, now my first sponsor, Bob, he would guard your anonymity at the level of that ship, but he never tried to guard his own so he could be of service at any time. So the guy who answered the phone said, yeah, Mr. 12 Steps, we know all about him. So they go down and get Bob. Bob comes to get me. Carl, wake up. And they're like, oh, okay. And so I hop into Bob's car, and we start driving down to the Coronado Bridge. And as we're driving, Bob says, "Carl, grab the big book out of the glove box. Bone up on working with others." It's like, "Huh, okay." It says, "See your man alone if possible, Bob." He says, "Oh, forget it. We're going to wing it." So we get down to the base of the Coronado Bridge, and everything that San Diego County has available for a situation like this is there. The police department is there. The paramedics are there. The fire department is there. The on-duty psychologist is there, and they have a telephone system wired up to him up at the top of the bridge. And Bob and I start walking up on the scene here, and the fireman, who seems to be in charge, looks over at us and goes, "Is one of you Bob W?" And Bob goes, "Yeah, that's me." He goes, "I don't know what you're going to do. We've been talking to him for an hour, and he's not budging, but go ahead." Hands him the telephone, and Bob says, "Blair?" And you can hear on the other end, "Bob, is that you?" Bob says, "Yes, Blair, now get the hell down from that bridge." And you're, "Okay." One alcoholic can affect another alcoholic like no one else can. Don't forget that. We need to take our seats in our home group. 2 years sober, got an honorable discharge. That is a result of a merciful God, the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a personnelman that lost half my file. That's how I got a... And as I told you, I was going to school, I was making an amends to my parents, and I had chosen the university in an area of Los Angeles called Covina. And through having to make all the other amends, I was still broke. I was getting a Navy paycheck, and I'll maybe talk about this later this weekend if I get around to talking to that portion of my sobriety. But I was broke, and I was still push-starting the same car that I got sober in, a 68 Volkswagen, hole in the floorboard. I had to push-start it. It hits on about two cylinders, right? The headlight, it has duct tape on it, and, you know, coat hangers are keeping things together. And everything I own is in that car, and I'm 2 years sober, and I'm driving up the L.A. freeways, and I'm thinking, I need a life. I really need a life. I've heard people talk about that in AA. I need to go get a life. I won't have much time to go to meetings because I need to work, I need to go to school, and I need to get a life. And then I'll get active again in AA, but I need to get a life. And I decided I would just stop in this town of Covina to see where the meeting hall was so that if I needed a meeting while I'm getting a life, I would know where I could go if I needed a meeting. And I pulled into a noon meeting, and Bob and I had made an arrangement that I needed a new sponsor because he still had 2 more years to do in the Navy. And the ship was leaving for Asia for 9 months. So I was not even going to be able to communicate with him. So he had said I needed to get a new sponsor. But I wasn't thinking about that. I'm thinking about getting a life. And I pulled into this AA club for a noon meeting. And the man making coffee that day was a man named Eddie Cochran, one of the pioneers of Southern California Alcoholics Anonymous. And he walked up to me. And he had a medallion hanging around his neck with a circle and triangle. And it said 1951. Now I did the math. That meant he was 10 years sober when I was born. And he walked over to me and he said the very same thing that that man said to me when I was fresh out of treatment, at my first meeting out of treatment. And he said, "Never seen you before. What are you doing?" Now, this time I had a much better answer. I said, "Sir, I'm 2 years sober and I'm fresh out of the United States Navy. And I just moved here to go to the university. You won't see me very much because I'm going to be very, very busy. And I'm going to be, other than taking 21 units at the university, I'm going to have to work to support myself. And I need to get a life. I need to get a life. And once I get a life, I'll get active again in AA. But you won't see me very much. But it's nice to meet you. And it's nice to see where the meeting hall is." And Eddie, if you ever knew him, he had this laugh. It was like, and he said, "Oh, son. School and work, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. But that's what we do in between meetings." And what he was really telling me is one of the secrets to long-term sobriety comfortably in AA. And what he was really telling me is that I need to live in Alcoholics Anonymous and visit the world instead of trying to hash it out there in the world and visiting Alcoholics Anonymous when convenient. One of the first things he told me I needed to do was put newcomers in my car. And I objected at first. Eddie, I would, but I've got a hole in the floorboard. I have to push start the car. One of them might fall through the floorboard. He said, put new guys in your car, your life will get better. Now, I didn't see how this is going to work, but I took his direction simply because he was 10 years sober when I was born. And the very first night that I followed this man's direction, my life got better. I remember after the meeting looking over my shoulder, and my life had already gotten better. The new guys were push starting my car for me. He didn't say how much better, he just said better. I have found a life in Alcoholics Anonymous that I did not even know was available for a man like me. See, my problem is that I don't know how to see the colors of life on my own. I do not know how to hear the music of life, and I don't know how to connect with my brothers and sisters. The only way I was able to do that before was somewhere between the fifth and eighth drink, and I was never able to do that when you took alcohol away from me. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to do is to see the colors of life, to hear the music of life, and to be able to connect with my brothers and sisters in a profound way that I did not even know was available. Another thing that I can describe to you that's happened to me in the 24 years that I've been here. I'll tell you this story, and this can pretty much sum it up, especially with my family. This must have been 1998, and I was asked to come down to Nogales, Arizona for, you know, a conference of some sort. And I don't know if you guys remember, you guys had cell phones way before everybody in the U.S., but in 1998, some people had cell phones, but not everybody, but lots of people carried these pagers, right? Anybody under 25 years old goes, a pager? What's a pager? Right? And we would have nationwide coverage, but there'd be these big blackout areas where your pager wouldn't work. So before I left for Nogales, Arizona, and anybody ever been to Nogales, Arizona? It's like the armpit of the United States. I mean, there is nothing there. Before I left, I called my mother, and I go, Mom, if you try to page me this weekend and I don't answer, I don't want you to worry. I have to go to Nogales, Arizona, and I'll be there until Sunday evening, and then I'll check back with you. But don't worry, that's where I'm at. She goes, oh, you're going to be in Nogales. Oh, you need to call up Don and Leona. They would love to hear from you. And I go, remind me, Mom, and she goes, oh, that's right. You probably haven't seen them since you were 9 years old. Oh, you can't remember, they've been lifelong friends. Don was the best man at your father's and my wedding. And I go, oh, that's right. Yes, I know who that is. So I called up Don before I left, and I go, Don, this is Carl Morris, and I'm going to be down in Nogales, apparently just 20 miles south of you, and maybe on Saturday afternoon I could drive up and we could have a cup of coffee or some lunch. And he goes, oh, Carl, bring your golf clubs. I know you love to golf. And I'm like, well, how does he know that? It's true, I'm like a golf whore. I'll golf with anybody at any time for any reason. Right? I don't even need to know your name. I'll golf with you. But I was surprised that he knew that. So I brought my golf clubs with me, and on Saturday morning, I left the conference, and I drove up the freeway, and I met him at his golf course. And we started to walk along and golf. And as we were walking along and talking, he was asking me very specific, pertinent questions about my life. And the more questions he asked, it was obvious. He knew, you know, what school, what university I graduated from, what my degree was in, what companies I'd been in, what the recovery homes I'm involved. He just knew everything about my life. It was obvious by his questions. And I was trying to squeeze in a couple of questions. You know, I hadn't seen him since I was 9, and to find out why they had moved from Duluth, Minnesota, down here to Tucson, Arizona. You know, I didn't know anything, but I was trying to find out. But he knew everything. And so by the fourth hole, I said, Don, I'm really confused. How on earth do you know all this about my life? I haven't seen you in 20 years. He said, oh, that's easy, Carl. Before your father passed away in 1996, you couldn't shut him up. He would just go on and on. It was kind of irritating, but we listened. He would just go on and on about everything you were doing in your life inside AA and outside of AA. He was just so proud. Now, this wasn't news to me. I knew that because I had taken your direction, and I had not procrastinated on reconnecting with my father. Now, this is true in my life. I don't know about your situation, but in my life, had I procrastinated and not reconnected with my father man to man, and he had passed away before, if he would have passed away before I took your direction to do this, I would have lived the rest of my life as half a man. Now, that's true in my case, maybe not yours. But don't procrastinate. So it wasn't news to me to hear this, but it was nice to hear from a lifelong friend. But the next thing he said, I couldn't even swing a golf club anymore, because he said, and besides, every year, Carl, I get that Christmas letter. I'm like, yes! I'm in that thing now! When I was 17 years sober, I got married for the first time in my life. We had two beautiful kids, Madison and Ryan. They are 4 years old and 6 years old. Unfortunately, the marriage did not work out. I know that's very uncommon in AA. It's a tragic story. No, we worked out a really good, amicable situation in order that we can co-parent these children, and it's working out beautifully so far. We've been divorced now for 3 years, and we are really good friends, and we are good parents. And I never knew, and if you don't have children, you may not know, because when I used to hear people talk about their children in AA, I would just, oh, yeah, but I didn't know it the way I know it now, that there's this level of love for another human being that is deeper and more profound. It's like you meet who you would die for gladly if it meant they could live. I've experienced what I like to call reminded unconditional love. That's where you're acting like a jerk. I remember, oh, that's right, love is unconditional. Oh, yes. But here with my children, it's instinctual unconditional love. I don't need to think about it. It's just there. And I love my children with all my heart. And I would never trade my children for the first drink. Never in a million years would I trade my children for the first drink. But I'm alcoholic. I understand my alcoholism. Although I would never trade them for the first drink, I would trade them for the second drink, like that. Because once I take a drink, all bets are off about anything that I care about. So there's nothing more important in my life than to stay in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. Absolutely nothing more important in my life than to stay in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to thank you for listening to me tonight. And I'm going to be here all weekend, and we're going to be doing some other stuff and having a good time talking about steps. And again, I love being an Icelander. And I love being an alcoholic Icelander. Good night.